Okay, everyone, welcome to another episode of Free for All. This is your host, Big John. And today I'm very happy to have someone who is one of the up-and-coming voices out there for a lot of the issues that are of importance today. Let me introduce you to Jill Jacobson from The Young Voices, appropriately enough, an organization that has a lot of great young libertarian and conservative opinion makers, opinion writers. Jill is a third-year law student at Boston College Law School, and she also has a master's degree in international relations from Northwestern University. So someone, obviously, who's a lot smarter than I am, who will help us navigate some of these issues that we're going to talk about today. Jill, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure having you. Okay, so I was very interested in an article you co-authored with Rachel Chu, another Young Voices person. And it was in the New York Post, my hometown paper. And it was it struck me as very interesting because it talked about how academia is churning out folks who have a very orthodox, in their view, very groupthink position on a lot of issues of major importance, that independent thought really isn't encouraged at this point. And the issue that triggered this was the response to the Hamas terrorist attacks on Israel. And this was something that was in the news that obviously took me by surprise a little bit, in the sense that it was a blanket condemnation of Israel, of all things, in the wake of a terrorist attack. So before we get into the details, let me toss it over to you. Can you encapsulate what you covered in your article very high level so we can get the folks up to date with what your position was on this?
Yeah, definitely. So on October 7th of this year, more than 1,400 Israeli citizens and some American nationals were murdered. A lot of the women were raped, kidnapped, and there are several hostages. And this was done by Hamas, which is a terrorist organization in Palestine. And while much of the country responded with shock and horror at, you know, the sheer inhumanity of these attacks, the size of them, it took people completely by surprise. Academia had a very different reaction, which was that really in the hours and days right after the attack, there was not condemnation, but support of Hamas, laying the blame of the attacks directly on the shoulders of Israel. And some people even calling it exhilarating or awesome. Those are direct quotes from two professors. So really just a surprising reaction to brutal, brutal terrorist attacks.
Yeah. And just to, I'm hoping I get this right. The two professors you were referring to were Zarina Grewal and Russell Rickford. One's from Yale and the other one is from Cornell, I believe. And you're right. Now, what's interesting here to me is that it wasn't even a sort of like an anti-Israel position based on any sort of argument. It was just like this blanket response, Israel's bad, Hamas is in the right here. And Hamas, you mentioned, a terrorist organization, it is both the political and military, for lack of a better term, organization for Palestinian autonomy, Arab autonomy in Gaza. So why do you think that is, though? Why do you think we are in academia? Like, given that academia, listen, I'm a libertarian. I'll join in with my conservative friends who claim that that academia is largely a left-wing or Marxist environment ever since the mid-60s, I would say. I'm trying to be as fair as possible. In a lot of those cases, you might make the argument that their leftism, their liberalism, was an outgrowth of some sort of humanitarian, secular humanitarian position, feed the poor, increase civil liberties, things of that nature. You know, at least it is to someone of my age, where I can remember where the left were still the hippies. They were still the ones fighting for free speech, right? But this is very strange to me that if you are from that sort of background, right, how can you praise a terrorist attack, even if you don't label it terrorist, if you think it was a justified military response to aggression, how can you justify these attacks on civilians, non-military targets? Where do you think that shift comes from?
Yeah, I think as a threshold matter, right, there's a difference between weighing in on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Two groups claiming ancestral ties to the same piece of land. That is a legitimate political debate that we can have. And what are the cultural ramifications and the sociological ramifications, the humanitarian ones, all of those sorts of things, right? And then there is, are you in support of extremely violent means by terrorists in order to achieve your desired outcome on that debate, right? In the wake of the attacks, there was no room for the former debate, right? Then was not the appropriate time to have a referendum on what you think about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict more broadly. But they didn't even do that. Most people in academia didn't say, okay, now's the time to have a debate about this foreign relations issue. Right. It was blanket. Yes, the means totally justify the ends. So why is that? Rachel and I write in our article that we think that this is the perfect example of the culmination of several trends that have actually been going on in academia for a long time. We've seen several manifestations of it, but this one is so egregious that the general public's kind of waking up and seeing, oh my goodness, what is going on in these institutions? Right. And the two trends that we credit for the creation of this phenomenon are, one, admissions decisions, and two, some of the frameworks that are really popular that are taught in academia today. So as far as admissions, you know, you've seen increasingly, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years, admissions offices are placing a lot of emphasis on demonstration of social justice activism in potential applicants for college admissions over intellectual merit purely. So in the Ivy Leagues particularly, but at a lot of schools, you know, the student body is no longer a representative sample of kids with the top grades and the top SAT scores. It is a representative sample of kids who are very skilled at conveying social justice activism on their resumes. And what Rachel and I sort of highlight anecdotally is I've changed my mind on so many fundamental issues since the age of 17. I think we all have. But if you have these kids demonstrate their social justice views via their resume, you then reward them with admissions to elite universities, and then you bring them to an environment where their professors share those views and keep telling them, you're so special for having these views. This is your ticket to success. They have no incentive to question those views, let alone change them. And so now we're creating these really homogenous student bodies where students feel such conviction in views that they formed, frankly, very, very young. So that's the admissions piece of it. And then the academic frameworks, the ideological frameworks that are taught in schools teach very, very binary thinking that has very little room for nuance. The one that's coming up a lot in public discourse and is shown in this conflict is colonialism, that someone is the colonist, someone is the colonizer and the colonized, and that is where the conversation begins and ends. It doesn't matter if it was hundreds of years ago. It doesn't matter in this case if there's a long history of Jewish people in the region. It doesn't matter. The colonial project sort of has to be dismantled, and it doesn't matter what means are used to reach that end, even if they're very, very violent. And that those are sort of the narratives that we're seeing clash in academia right now.
Yeah, excuse me. And it is very, it is a continuation of even, look, I'm an old man. And I remember when I was in university, you could not be a conservative, or forget libertarian, but you couldn't even be a conservative in those days without running afoul of your professors. And it was the very rare professor who would appreciate that you were making a nuanced argument, an argument based on principle, as opposed to just chiming in with the crowd. So I could see where something that was happening to me in the 80s, where I would have to sit in my poli sci courses and debate certain issues openly, at risk of not getting a good grade. But I could see that now it's become even more polarized, that it's not even just agreeing and becoming sort of the teacher's pet, but it's then having to amplify that through social media, through virtue signaling and whatnot. Like, hey, I'm anti-colonist, therefore I'm anti-Israel. And I certainly see that. But let me ask you this. Do you think it is a lack of academic rigor that also contributes to this? For example, if I were to, say, go to your classmates at law school and ask them, when did Israel become a nation? How many do you think would actually know the answer to that?
So I think that's difficult to say purely because law school is an amalgamation of students that come from lots of different disciplines, right? That being said, if you've gone through education in the United States and you have paid hundreds of thousands of dollars oftentimes, and now you're in graduate school, where many of them will go work in government on behalf of the United States, and they don't know basic history of which the United States was a major part, right, that's problematic. But I think even more so, it's that a lot of these students who are my age, they grew up in sort of an elementary and middle and high school system where they were learning these things. It's that those things sort of tend to drop off now at the university and graduate level, and what is replaced is political discussions without the historical context. So they're having the discussions, there's just no information and nuance to back them up, which might be more insidious, frankly.
I think you're right about that, because just anecdotally, when I talked, so a lot of my professional work was done in marketing agencies. And of course, that's a young person's game. I always mention that I might be, you know, if I'm in my 50s, most of my charges at work would have been in their 20s or fresh out of college. And a lot of times I always try to relate to my, so I said at their age, when I was in my 20s, did I know about events and cultural events that happened 30 years earlier, you know, say in the 50s? And I think the honest answer is yes. You know, I knew about McCarthyism. I understood the interplay between the Red Scare and things of that nature, right? But what I noticed at the time, and I think is still the case, could that statement be made of students today? Are students today aware of the previous generations, say 25 to 30 years, social concerns, political landscapes, and things like that? And unfortunately, I think the answer is no. And I don't even think that it's necessarily limited to any particular political affiliation. So I don't think the liberals are any worse than the conservatives, because I'm looking at some of my libertarian brethren here on Twitter, opinion makers and influencers. I'm shocked at how many just view this as your law students, the law students you reference and the law professors you reference in your article with Rachel, that they just view it as Israel's a colonizer. Now, if someone were willing to have a political discussion with me, and like you said, not in a soundbite, but, you know, given a half hour to discuss the situation, yes, I could find issues with the Zionist movement when it started at the late 19th century. How they claimed a certain area of what was then known as Palestine, and then the British mandate for Palestine, and so on and so forth, leading up to the Holocaust and the outgrowth of that, which resulted in the formation of Israel in 1948. I'm up for that discussion. Like, you know, how far back do ancestral claims go? That's another one. My origin is Greek. Do I get to claim Constantinople from Turkey these days because 1,000 years ago my ancestors had a right to it? I think I would look silly making that claim, right? Or most Greeks would look silly making that claim today. Does the same? So what is the correct answer? Does anyone know? Like, how far back do ancestral claims go? How valid are religious claims on secular matters? I think these are very nuanced, complicated, possibly unsolvable issues, right? But I'm willing to have that conversation about them.
And the irony is that academia is the perfect place to have those conversations. You rarely get a concentration of people with so many different intellectual expertise. I mean, if one wanted an arena to source experts for that sort of conversation, academia should be it. And yet it's not.
Right. You would think that a place like Harvard or NYU or Cornell or any of these Ivy League or high quality schools, or at least used to be high quality schools, you might be able to find that conversation. But more and more, you're finding that you have to turn to podcasts to figure this stuff out or to get a good conversation going. Do you feel that in particular, when it comes to Israel and Hamas and the situation you observe with this backlash, there's two things I want to mention. One is most of the people that I've seen doing the backlash are either people of color or Arab Americans who have that, you know, sort of background and bias in their opinions. Now, for example, when Zarina Grewal says something, you know, she describes herself as a militant Muslim. So you might expect her to have that opinion. And that doesn't necessarily, while I still think it's wrong to praise civilian attacks on civilians, I don't find her comments were less offensive to me given the context of her background.
Sure.
But what I find a little interesting is that, for example, minority groups in the United States seem to be aligning with the terrorist position on these things. So, for example, I believe Professor Rickford, is that his name? Professor Rickford is an African-American. I think there's a lot of other Twitter commentators that I've seen that I would categorize as either a minority, meaning they're not WASPs in the U.S. They tend to side with the more radical position. Do you feel there's a tie-in politically based on that shared experience? Like, for example, if I tend to be for reparations, if I'm pro-reparations in the U.S., I would probably tend to align more and support Hamas in this situation. If I tend to be a white nationalist in the U.S., which is a minority numerically, but not racially, if I tend to be a white nationalist in the U.S., I will tend to support the Hamas position, right? Because I tend to be anti-Zionist. Do you feel there's any sort of that type of tie-in in what you're seeing in academia, that there might be these tie-ins to these other U.S. movements that they then reach out and say, like, hey, we're aligned with our, quote, ideological brothers in Palestine?
Yeah, I think there is a superficial and frankly paradoxical tie-in, but there surely is one, which is that certain groups have begun to view the Israelis as the oppressors, Jews as the oppressors, which is very ironic, given that they are perhaps the most oppressed group in history. I mean, the entire existence of the Jewish people has been outrunning oppression from various groups. That is sort of the story of the Jewish people. And yet, in this topsy-turvy world where Israel has achieved remarkable success for its size and history, it is now the oppressor. And strangely enough, Jews are now considered white for the first time in history. So, you know, in years prior, in eras prior, the Jewish people used to be hand in hand with the groups you just mentioned because they were sticking up for the little guy. They were sticking up for the oppressed. Now you're seeing this shift where that's no longer the case. And I think that has a lot to do with it, certainly.
Yeah. And that is another fascinating thing that you just mentioned, that living my entire life in New York, which has a very high Jewish population, politically, Jews tended to be aligned or viewed politically as a liberal voting bloc, and a voting bloc that was very much aligned with the civil rights movement, with minority rights movements, with the labor unions. Everything that you could think was a liberal cause, a traditional liberal cause, the Jews as a voting bloc were always considered supporters. And it was something that happened even in the 90s. I realized when you started seeing like the Al Sharptons of the world, Jesse Jacksons, starting to criticize that very voting bloc, you know, and it was something that to me was very strange politically, that here's a group that not only supported you with words, monetarily supported you, which, let's face it, is a huge portion of this. It's like, where do you get the resources to support your causes? And turning on them seemed very strange to me from a strategic point of view. And just if I were to view it that coldly, it always baffled me.
Yeah, I think to touch on domestic politics for a moment, we are seeing a lot of liberal Jews who have identified with the left for a very long time sort of look back and think, we have always been there for these groups of people at every moment. And now in our hour of need, we look around and we are completely alone. And I am curious to see how Jews on the left sort of respond to this, whether there is some migration to the right after this. It's certainly an interesting and very unfortunate part of this.
I definitely see that. And what's interesting here is that As I was reading your article, which is, I recommend to everyone, we'll put the link in the notes of the podcast for everyone to just hop on the New York Post website and read your article. But I was thinking that in a lot of ways, when you confuse, so first of all, the situation in the Middle East with Israel, Hamas, the PLO, the Fatah, everything out there is so complex and so confusing. At first, I was going to try to draw an analogy, say, to the IRA and Sinn Féin and say, like, okay, so there's a similar type of situation, right? Obviously, but it's really not. Like, that pales in comparison in terms of its complexity. I was going to ask you, do you think there's some issue there? I mean, we already said we don't think that most people intellectually are up to date on what's going on there, the complexities and everything. But one of the things I've noticed is that with – on the Israeli side of the fence, it's just Israel, right? There's no gradations there. There's no subtlety there. It's the nation of Israel, the Jewish home state, right? That's very clear. On the Arab side, you have the PLO, which is both a political and a military organization. You have Hamas, which is both political and military. You have Fatah, which is political and military. So unlike even the situation with Ireland, Ulster and Britain, at least there you had at least the pretense of a separation between the political and the military. You had the IRA and you had Sinn Féin. One was the political arm, one was the military arm. Even if it was superficial, you could say, well, Sinn Féin's working to do things politically and the IRA is trying to do things in terms of terrorism, right? I think that's lacking because it's all conflated. There's like one PLO that does both, right? There's one Hamas that's allegedly does both. So do you think that contributes to the confusion over there, that it's very easy to pick out Israel because Israel is a monolith, it's single, it's homogenous. Whereas when you look at the rest of Palestine and the Palestinian question, it's you're dealing with, I mean, I just mentioned six. I'm sure there's dozens more out there that are claiming some right to some part of what was considered ancient Palestine. Do you think that's part of the trouble there?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of the equation. I think, you know, commentary in the United States, you see these false equivalencies, like if you don't support Hamas, then you're supporting the murder of Gazans. That is a very strange logical leap to make, considering that much of Gaza's humanitarian crisis is a direct result of mismanagement by Hamas. Right. So you sort of see people think, I support Palestinian rights or I support human rights, therefore I support Hamas. That is a very uninformed position to take, but it's increasingly ubiquitous in this discourse, which is very, very concerning because you're seeing on television Hamas leaders very openly saying, you know, our plan is to take back the land that we're entitled to. And the news reporter will say, oh, the Gaza Strip. And they'll say, no, Israel too. Right. Very blanketly. I mean, there is no hiding the ball here. And so to create the logical equivalent that if you support human lives, you therefore support a terrorist organization that wishes to wipe Israel off the map. I mean, not only is that logically incorrect, but it is a very dangerous precedent to set.
It is. And again, I think there's a lot of people that don't realize that. For example, I believe 22% of Israel's population is actually Arab. They're Arab citizens.
Yeah, living, 2 million people.
Yeah, living as Israeli citizens. So there is that complication. I do understand the complexities, even if you're pro-Palestinian. I mean, people forget Golda Meir used to describe herself as a Palestinian Jew. She didn't describe herself as Israeli. She didn't describe herself as just Jewish. She said, I'm a Palestinian Jew. So that's almost the irony of all this. And the sad part of this, these are peoples that are so intertwined in history, almost indistinguishable from each other. Obviously the religious differences are highly divisive, and literally that's what's happening there. That I think, honestly, if it weren't for the religious, if it was a secular issue, it would have been solved a while ago, that you could have had a two-state solution and probably we would have moved on from this. But again, I think it's very complicated. And to just boil it down, as you said, to just one, like, now let me ask you this, because to be fair, do you think that Israel, in terms of PR, is handling the situation correctly? So your article made the point that several private sector companies, law firms, et cetera, when they got that Harvard letter signed by, what was it, 30 or 40 students condemning Israel for being attacked by Hamas, which even saying it sounds ludicrous, but I'm looking down my notes, the law firm of Winston and Strawn, you call out billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman, Israeli billionaire Idan Offer, I hope that's the way I pronounce his name, who sits on the board of a lot of Ivy League universities, stepped down, cut off donations. To the people who kind of view as, quote, an Israeli conspiracy in the U.S., do you feel this furthers that opinion? For example, even libertarians, you see a lot of pushback that why are we so beholden to Israel? Why, Hollywood is controlled by the Jews. The banks are controlled by the Jews. You hear those old racist tropes. And then this follows on the heels of that. Now, I'm not saying it's warranted or unwarranted. I'm saying from the position of, if you're trying to push your cause forward, was this positive or negative in that sense? Meaning the private sector reaction to the statements by the Harvard students and some faculty.
Sure. You know, I think I reject those views wholesale, but if I were to step into the mind of someone who has that view of the Jewish people's sort of interaction with the economy and society at large, I would say that these law firms and billionaires and major companies coming out and saying, we're not going to hire students, we don't want to donate to these universities, we don't want to spend our time advising organizations who are supporting this sort of thing, I don't think it's so much political commentary on where they stand or don't stand with Israel. I think it's more so, we're companies. We need to make money. We need to hire individuals that are capable of critical thinking and taking a moral stance on something, right? I don't think it's a political stance on Israel if a law firm says, we need lawyers who are capable of nuance, not that categorically take a stance on something abhorrent because it's part of some larger social contagion on their campus. So I would say the actions of the private sector have more to do with sending a message to the university that you are creating employees that are not employable by our companies for X, Y, and Z reason.
I see that from an intellectual point of view. I agree with you. But for example, I'm again playing devil's advocate without giving merit to any side of the argument here. But if I'm an employer, I might also, if I were to take that position, I might also say, well, I don't want these kids coming out of college who insist on asking me what my pronouns are when they get to a, sure, to a job interview, right? But I really haven't seen that, right? Like, I haven't seen law firms say, like, when you come in and as the interviewer, I'm sitting in front of you, because I've had this happen to me, which I find hilarious. I've interviewed kids and they'll be like, what are your pronouns? You know, like, that is a political question as far as I'm concerned. It's not like a critical thought. It doesn't show me. And the fact that you're so in line with it is a negative to me. But I haven't seen any firms come out and say, we're not putting up with any of this, like, pronoun nonsense, compelled speech nonsense, because we do believe in free speech. We do believe in critical thought. I could make the argument that the same applies to those types of issues coming off of campuses, but I haven't seen the private sector react the way they have to the Hamas-Israel question. So if you could put your shoes, again, in your opponent's, your ideological opposition, put yourself in their shoes. I guess what I'm asking is the fact that the private sector came out so quickly and decisively to say, we're not hiring those students, we're rescinding any offers we may have made to them, and by the way, we are taking away donations and et cetera. Do you feel that further strengthens, again, admittedly racist beliefs, right? That will be, oh, there they go. They control the media. They control the banking system. They, right? I mean, do you think, and again, not giving credence to that belief, but to say in some weird way, is your response wholly justified, further deepening those racist beliefs in the people you're trying to persuade?
Sure. Well, this gets to whether you view the reactions by these students as moral questions, as a moral response, or as a political one. Mm. Let me pose a question to you. If I'm your lawyer and you're a client of Jacobson LLC, and I walk in and I say, you know, I would like to be called he, him, let's say.
Yeah.
Then next time I walk in and I have a swastika painted on my face, which one are you more willing to put up with?
Right. But I think the example you gave is a little more startling, right? You're talking about a physical appearance and persuading judges and whatnot. So, but I understand your point. And obviously that comes down to individual choice. Now, believe me, as a libertarian, always being the third wheel in any political discussion, our whole existence relies on persuading people, right? That I have to sit down, undo hundreds of years worth of duopolistic thinking to introduce you to my point of view. I'm not going to beat you up. I'm not going to hit you or anything like that. But I have to sit there and persuade you, right? So I'm the wrong person to ask that question, because I will always, anyone I do business with, whether it's here at Grumblings Media or anywhere else, anywhere, you know, I'm having a discussion with you, right? Like you said to me, for those little inside baseball here before the interview started, Rachel said, oh, this is a great opportunity. Jill, this is a great opportunity. I don't have to speak in sound bites. You know, we get to discuss, right? Well, that's part of my sort of response to things, right? I want to talk to people. I want to engage people. That's my decision. But if all of a sudden someone were to come in, if you were to say to me, Jill, I only want to speak in sound bites. I only want to talk in 30-second clips, right? I might have decided you weren't the right guest for the show. Right. So I'm a different person.
Right. And that's your choice as a business to decide the sorts of people that you'd like to bring on and interview.
Right.
Which I think is akin to the way that these law firms are thinking. We have full discretion to hire employees who exhibit certain skills and are willing to step up to the task that we demand of
right.
them.
Right. So do you think that
the sound bites?
Right. Right. I agree. But do you think that the fallout, I'm not faulting the law firms and the hedge funds and whatever from rescinding those offers. I'm not faulting that. I will never fault anyone on that. What I'm asking is, do you feel it's not furthering the persuasive opportunity for dialogue or to change hearts and minds, because the people you're trying to persuade may actually be hardened into their position by this reaction? So I'm asking more about what you think the fallout is, not necessarily whether or not they had the right or they did the morally correct thing by rescinding those offers. I think they have every right to do that as a libertarian. I'm like, private business can do whatever they want. I'm saying, like, if your goal is to, like, I want to reach out and reach out to these pro Hamas folks and get them to see that that as a Jew, I'm not, or an Israeli or a Zionist, I am not the devil incarnate. I am not out killing Christian babies and drinking their blood, like whatever these old crazy things were. Like, if my goal is to drive that into the background and to eliminate that to the greatest extent possible, did those actions achieve that goal or hurt them, or did they stay neutral?
I think people have sort of reached their limit of pleading with universities for the kind of free speech environment that might be conducive to that. So if anything, this is the private sector throwing their hands up and saying, you know, I'm not sure how much else, what else we can do. Right. I mean, Rachel and I discussed this because we've both been in academia, you know, for several years now, in graduate school, now in law school. Please, to change this environment to be more conducive to intellectual diversity and debate, have been long in the making. This is just another manifestation of a long trend of that seriously lacking in academia. So I think, you know, holding these students to account of what they're saying and sort of saying, if you're going to march around Harvard Yard and proselytize that this is your position, well, then you should be okay with owning that when employers hold you to account. So I actually think teaching students that words that they say really do mean something. And if you want to be intellectually curious and engage in open debate and stand by your views, or, you know, have the opportunity to change them, shockingly enough, that would be a great thing. But you cannot go and say these unbelievable things that frankly encourage a lot of anti-Semitism, violence we're now seeing, and then expect to go work at a white shoe law firm. It's just not on the table.
It's unrealistic, and it certainly gives you a lesson in accountability, I would say, that, all right, you hold those positions. Hey, again, free speech, go ahead, hold those positions. But there might be people who disagree with you who are in a position to hire you. And I think that's the issue that you have to, that a lot of, I say kids, but it's really a lot of people really, they expect to have their cake and eat it too. Like, I could say all these crazy things and I expect no repercussions. I expect everybody to laud me, as you said, just for being part of the crew that says these things. And then all of a sudden, hey, I can't get a job anymore.
Yeah, I think too, these businesses are sort of also sending a message to the administrators and the deans of these universities. Yes, they're directing the students themselves, but a secondary recipient of these letters and statements by law firms and other companies are the administrators saying, if you want us to employ your graduates, please change this environment such that they develop the skills that we need them to.
Yeah, and since you touched on it, let me ask you this without, you know, and if you're uncomfortable answering, I certainly understand since you're still in school, but why do you think administrators, especially of Ivy League schools considered the cream of the crop, why do you feel they're so quick to embrace these types of positions, this type of activism, this type of virtue signaling? I would think the last thing, if I'm the president of Harvard, if I'm the president of Yale or Cornell or UPenn or whatever, the last thing I would want is a monolithic campus where homogeneous campus where everybody thinks the same, everybody has the same opinion. I would think as a pure academic, I'm hoping that they would be like, that is the worst thing I could have for this university, that I should be able to have a classroom on Zionism 101, and that I could have half the class be pro-Zionist. I could have the other half be anti-Zionist. They could have their debates and their conversations, and yet they'll still go to the cafeteria and share a lunch, right? You would hope you could foster that type of environment. But to your point, that's not the case, right? Why do you think colleges, universities are so quick to adapt this homogeneous, monolithic sort of thinking where there's really no conversation, not just on the Israel Hamas issue, but on everything, whether it's you know, the compelled speech, whether it's political whatever, you know, whether or not, you know, I remember when I was on campus, the big debate was whether or not homosexuality was genetic or environmental, believe it or not. not back then. You know, that was the big debate. And it took a lot to have people from both sides, sociologists, biologists, geneticists, whatever, political science people, come back and have that argument, have that debate, present their proof. Where does that exist now? Why are campuses so quick to adapt that monolithic view?
Yeah, I am convinced that being a university administrator or dean in 2023 might be the hardest job on the planet. I, for one, would not sign up if given the opportunity. But, you know, if I were dean for the day, I would stay neutral on all of these things. I mean, institutions should be neutral forums for learning. They should not be taking political or moral stances on these issues. That being said, I think they're in the position where they're forced to, right? Because they're balancing the students and the professors and the parents and the donors and the employers. They are trying to balance a lot of competing factions that all come together on university campuses. And increasingly, we see students wanting them to be politically active, wanting them to make these statements, asking them to condemn or not to condemn things. The irony is now that they've decided to engage in this sort of dialogue, there's some selectivity in the causes that they so openly condemn. You know, when George Floyd was brutally killed, every university and business in the country had a diatribe on it. And I don't fault them for that, given our political environment. Most schools, when Russia invaded Ukraine, had something very similar. It was radio silence when Hamas attacked Israel. Many student groups had to beg and plead with administrators to say something. And when they did, it often was very both sides and really did not take a strong moral stance against terrorism. So I think this is sort of a unique event in this trend of universities having to give some kind of commentary.
And again, do you feel it's because of an anti-Semitic undercurrent to that? Like, do you feel that even at the university level, in the administrator ranks, there is like a streak of anti-Semitism going on?
I think there are a lot of factors. I think one of the most important ones that is really under discussed is how much money from the Middle East flows into universities. I mean, a lot of countries from the Middle East, and I mean the government, donates millions and millions of dollars to most of the Ivy Leagues and lots of other American universities. That is really interesting, considering we don't let foreign governments donate a dollar to our campaigns. We don't let them do lots of things in the United States that would exert financial influence over our institutions. And yet we allow them to donate millions of dollars to academia that's supposed to bring up our next generation of leaders. That is strange. And I do think that that has a lot to do with whether universities will outright condemn Hamas or not in this circumstance, because a lot of these administrators are running businesses and they don't want to see these dollars go away.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess on some level, I think that sort of thing is fair play, again, in the private sector, meaning, and I consider universities to be the private sector, especially in the sense that we're talking about the elite schools. They're not state schools. So I'm conflicted about that. I think everyone, if they want to try to peddle influence through the universities, that's fine as far as I'm concerned, because I'm pretty sure you could have other groups also contributing. So I find that, I mean, it's interesting to know. So you're aware of it. Like, again, in terms of transparency, it's good to know, like, hey, 20% of the donations for Harvard or whatever the number happens to be is actually coming from the United Arab Emirates. And you're like, okay, I know that. I can choose whether to send my kids there. I can choose whether I want to attend based on that information. So I don't know that the actual donation bothers me as much as perhaps the secrecy behind it. That to me might be an issue, but I don't think the donations are. But it is interesting to me, the other point you made, that by fostering this environment, you're robbing the United States of its future leadership. And what I draw parallels to is in the 90s, I was working on Wall Street. And one of the things I noticed was that all middle management functions were eliminated. So you had this bifurcation of upper management and the worker bees. And the worker bees were outsourced to places like India, Brazil. Nothing wrong with that. But by eliminating the middle management, that meant your future leaders had to either come from one of two places. The people that you had outsourced the work to, who are not steeped in American context, are not steeped in American business, and very often chose to remain in their own countries rather than migrate here to be upper management. Or you were hiring vastly unqualified people out of college who had no management experience, and through a dearth of middle management, you just shoved them into senior vice president positions. And to this day, I hold that the 2008 financial crisis was largely due to a lack of middle managers who had grown through the ranks in this open business environment to become your senior managers, senior vice presidents, making these very critical decisions on leverage and, you know, things like that, not to get into the financial crisis. I kind of see the same thing in academia, that by taking away the almost adversarial nature of being in college to discuss these types of issues and these types of things where you're like, hey, why could Israel possibly be wrong in this context? Why could Hamas be possibly wrong in this context? Have those two butt heads, not just on that, on a whole host of issues. We are robbing the United States of its future political leaders who are going to be capable, have the experience, have the intellectual rigor to understand that nuance and to make decisions based on that nuance, right? We all like to think that the people in Washington are nuanced and they kind of understand all this. I don't know that they are. I think they're just like, whoever donates to me the most gets my vote on the matter. How do you feel about that? Do you think that we're robbing future leadership of this country by not having that intellectual honesty on campuses?
Certainly. I think our future political leadership, our future business leadership, I mean, I see it in law schools specifically, where the ability to understand your opposition's argument and respond in a calm, logical manner, devoid of emotion. I mean, that's the tools of the trade to being a lawyer. To be a lawyer is to contend with oppositional arguments and make your case, even if you might not personally believe it, because you're a zealous advocate for your client. I mean, that requires you embody an entirely different headspace that might be antithetical to your views. We're increasingly losing the opportunity to do that, and these will be our future leaders.
Yeah.
So it's very scary.
It is scary, Jill. Jill, I keep confusing you and Rachel. I apologize, Jill.
That's all right.
Jill, I do agree with you. And I will end the podcast by saying I'm also very happy you give me hope that people like you, Rachel, and your cohorts over at colleagues over at Young Voices are at least putting some critical thought to things. Even if I don't personally agree with all your positions, I do appreciate the fact that you guys are putting some elbow grease into your positions and your thought process. So I really appreciate that. Jill, please give us your contact info. If people want to follow you, read what you have, read your opinions, please let them know where they can find your work.
Yeah, definitely. I'm Jill C. Jacobson on Twitter, and I post all my articles there. Thank you for having me. This has been a really great conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. And hopefully we'll have you back to discuss some other great issues going forward. And for our viewers out there, don't forget, you've been watching Free for All from grumblingsmedia.com. I'll also apologize. I just noticed that I've been getting this glare on my chest. I'll see if I could get rid of it in post, but I'll apologize if I look all weird to people right now, but hopefully Jill, who has been looking perfect throughout the whole interview, that's the important thing here. Don't forget, you could join us on Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com, all the social media platforms, grumblingsmedia.com, Apple, Spotify, Pandora, our website, YouTube, Rumble, anything you can think of, Gab, Twitter, Facebook. We're everywhere. We're ubiquitous, much like a rash. So join us next time for the next Free For All. Until then, this has been Big John. Peace, everyone.